Skepticism and science are interdependent, which is not to say that scientists are necessarily good at skepticism when they step outside of their own subject matter of expertise. Our guest for this episode, episode number 7 of Iconocast, is Dr. Don Prosro. Don Prosro is a paleontologist who teaches in the Southern California area. He is also a writer with several textbooks to his credit, more than 300 science papers and articles, and has written and collaborated on books valuable to skeptics on cryptozoology, creationism, and UFOs. I'm Mike Harbrake, and my podcast partner, Dr. Greg Layden, asked Don to be our guest for this episode because his accomplishments as a leader of the skeptic movement dovetail nicely with his training as a paleontologist. He is able to talk about and write about the mammals of South America during its period of being a separate continent or an island continent, and explain how protein sequencing has provided evidence for questions in paleontology when DNA is no longer available. While he also talks about the lack of scientific rigor behind the quest for Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster. We also asked him about the errors he pointed to in his review of Dr. Lisa Randall's recent book on the demise of the dinosaurs. Don will soon be heading towards England and Scotland on a skeptics tour, including a boat ride on Loch Ness, and he gives us a preview of that trip. We'll also be talking to him about the state of the skeptics movement in a post-Amazing Meeting world. Have skeptics spread their wings enough that we can survive? Don and Greg, welcome to Iconocast.
I understand you're taking some time off right now from writing one of your books. I mean, you're taking a few minutes off from working on a book to talk to us. And yeah. You must have written, this is kind of embarrassing for the rest of us, you know. You've written over 30 books. You got to slow down so the rest of us don't look so bad.
But, oh, well, I'm afraid I can't. I've got too many contracts already lined up. So,
what is your current book that you're working on now about?
It's what you don't call shingling in academia, where you work on one, then you send it to somebody else and let them hold it for a while, and then you work on the next one. So last week I finished the index for a book I did for Smithsonian called Giants of the Lost World, which is about the island continent of South America and all the spectacular huge animals that live there, like the biggest dinosaurs and snakes the size of a school bus and things like that. That's all part of that story. And so they are now in production. I have nothing more I can do to that book. It'll be out in September since I had to index it last week. And so that was the last task for me. And then it's all completely their job. Right after I finished that, I had to finish a book on UFOs I'm doing for Indiana University Press. So I wrote the last two chapters that I hadn't already written and my co-author hadn't written. And I just shipped the last one of those chapters yesterday. And he has the whole book now. It's his job to go through it again and also to stick the art in that he's doing. And then we'll ship it later this week to Indiana to get a start for reviewing. So that shouldn't be out until probably next year because that's just now going to review. And then the minute I shipped that out last night, then I got started on this project I'm working on today, which is the last step for the Princeton Field Guide to Prehistoric Mammals, which I've actually worked on for several years now. And so its final stage, again, is doing the index. And it's much easier for me to do it than to try to get somebody else to try to do it and screw it all up. So it's a tedious job because basically I have to take the final page proof. But usually after 2 or 3 days, I'm hoping I'll finish in 3 days. I'll have all the index entries and I'll let words sort it alphabetically. Then you go in and do all the edits where you merge the duplications of, you know, the same entry with multiple pages and get all the italics right. And in this particular index, I've also got to go in and put in a pronunciation guide in for all the scientific names because most of them are not familiar to the average reader. So that's going to take, you know, a couple, 3 days, but I hope to ship it out before the week's over. And then I've got 3 papers for a volume for New Mexico Museum that I got with co-authors, student co-authors. I've got to get them shipped out to reviewers. I shipped 2 other papers I wrote alone about 2 weeks ago. So there's 5 papers going to that volume for the end of the month. And the last thing I know I've got to do is that sometime before I leave for Europe on July 6th, I'm supposed to get the page proofs of my book for Taylor Francis, which is called California's Amazing Geology. And so when the page proof arrives, I've got to check it and get all the mistakes out of it, send it back then for corrections, and then when I get back from Europe, I'll go and do the last stretch, which will index it. So
you're focusing on all the animals that ever lived on one continent, the really complex geology of the most complicated, geologically complicated state, and life on other planets.
That's sort of normal for me right now. Yeah.
Yes. Amazing.
Could you settle a bet for me then, Donald? I always suspected that you may have cloned yourself at some or copied yourself at one point.
I wish.
Because you've got all those things. I watch your Facebook feed, and I can see you're doing these things with your kids, and you're doing all this research, and you're still teaching, too. So I'm pretty amazed at all you're able to accomplish. It's pretty fascinating.
Well, thankfully, I'm done with teaching as of about 3 weeks ago, so this is why I'm working faster on books now, because my window of opportunity is very tight, so I basically don't have any time to stop. I just have to keep working until one task is done, then ship it out, and then start on the next one. And so I finished that UFO book last night, shipped it to my co-author, and first thing this morning I started indexing. And I've got to get this out of here because I've got to get those three papers that my students got off next. And then I got to write a couple of chapters with this book on Earth history that I promised Oxford. I've got to get a couple more chapters written and ship back to them before I take off. Because I'm going on July 6th, we fly out of here, and I'm running a Skeptic Society tour of the UK. And it's a geo tour, so it'll be mostly geology stops. But it'll also have a lot of history of science, so we'll visit Darwin's house and Darwin's birthplace and Isaac Newton's house and, you know, a bunch of other scientifically interesting places. You know, we're going to be in Edinburgh for several days, so we're going to talk about the scientific revolution and Scottish Enlightenment and James Hutton and the birth of geology, see all the key locations. So it's been – I custom designed the trip basically to do everything I wanted to do if I was going to be in the British Isles. And then we started selling it about 2 years ago, and it sold out within about 24 hours after it first was advertised. Then we added a second coach, and that sold out. So we had 98 people going in two coaches.
Wow.
So it's going to be a big tour. And I'm going to be in charge of coach number one. And my colleague Darren Naish, who's a British paleontologist at Southampton, has agreed to be the leader for group number two and coach number two. So some places we're going to all be together, one big giant group of 98. And we've got two bullhorns to handle it. But other times, because places can't handle us all at once, we're going in the same route but in opposite directions. So we'll hit the stops at different order, and that way we won't overwhelm anyone's spot with 98 of us at once. So we're going to stop at a coal mine in Wales near where my ancestors came from, probably my ancestors worked in. Actually going to visit the grave of my ancestors in the Brenhoven in Wales. And we're going to stop at a tin mine in Cornwall and a slate mine in northern Wales and a bunch of famous geologic sites. From the White Cliffs all the way to the Cornwall Peninsula and the Land's End all the way to the north coast of Scotland, and a lot of stuff in between, you know, like Hutton Stomping Ground and so on. And, you know, visits to Cambridge and Oxford. I've made arrangements so we get behind the scenes tours at the Naturalist Museum in London and behind the scenes tours at the Cambridge Naturalist Museum and also at the Oxford Naturalist Museum and also the Elgin Museum up in North Scotland. So this will be something no other tour could offer them because I have connections. And then, you know, we'll do other stuff. Like, this is a skeptic tour, so we're going to take a boat ride in Loch Ness and look for the monster. And, and then we're going to do fun stuff too. So one of our days in London will just be, you know, the standard day long tour of all the usual tourist sites, you know, Westminster Abbey and Tower London and St. Paul's and everything in between. Cause a lot of the people in this group, it's almost all Americans, a few Canadians, as far as you know, maybe two Brits. So. But mostly people are not that familiar with London, so we're going to give them the standard package tour as well, make sure they get all the basic sites in. And then my family and I is going to leave about a week early. We're going to stop in New York for 2 or 3 days because none of my family has been there except my wife and I. And I'll take my three boys with me, and we'll see all the things like the American Museum of Natural History where I was trained. And then we'll go to, of course, things like the Statue of Liberty and so on, things that the family enjoys. And then we fly from there directly to London, except for my eldest son who has to go back to work, so he flies home. And then the rest of my family will be in London for an extra 3 days or so before the tour starts, and we'll get in some sites that my family wants to see, because my youngest is crazy about animals and zoos and fossils and all the rest, sort of like I was at his age. So we're going to the London Zoo, of course, and we'll go to the Edinburgh Zoo, and we'll do a bunch of these natural history museums, which is what he cares for. So we'll do the London Zoo, and then we'll also probably go down to Sherlock Holmes Museum there in Baker Street, and maybe take a day out to Greenwich to see the observatory and the Cutty Sark and a few other things like that. So we'll try to get in some of the less familiar London sites that my family gets more out of. So then the tour starts.
It would be really funny if you guys actually found the Loch Ness Monster on this tour.
All 98 of us on one boat. Yeah, we have a lot of eyes. So,
yeah.
Well, I put a guidebook together, 100-page guidebook together for the whole trip. and it's got almost every bit of background stuff you could need for the trip like this. And I, you know, I used shortcuts, so I pasted in sections on things I'd written on blog posts and other books and so on. So this isn't technically a publication. I'm just using other material fairly freely. And a few places I published, pasted stuff from websites that I saved some time on, because I had to write the whole thing in under a week. So it was a real challenge to put that together very fast and get it there. It's already now in the hands of my contacts in London. They're going to get it printed and it'll be ready by the time the 14th of July when we meet. They'll have them ready to distribute along with the name badges and their baggage tags and all the rest. And then we'll check in with them in our first hotel where they're supposed to meet us. So
have you done a tour like this before?
For about the last decade, we've run a number of tours, but they've all been fairly small. For the, you know, previously they've been like weekend tours and 3-day tours. We often go on Martin Luther King weekend, which is January, which is a good time to go to the Mojave Desert and go on a 3-day tour. And we've done that a lot. And then, over the years, those are on buses, you know, going to both the public accessible areas, you know, like the Grand Canyon and Zion and Bryce. And one year we did a 6-day trip all the way from Los Angeles to Grand Junction, Colorado, mostly focusing on dinosaur localities and trilobite beds and, you know, Bryce and Zion and Canyonlands, things like that. A couple, 3 years ago, we got a little more ambitious and we organized a trip, which was a week long Alaska Inside Passage cruise from Seattle all the way to Glacier Bay and back. And we organized this on a, you know, big Holland America cruise line. So it was 3,000 people on the boat, but we had 300 of them, which was pretty good for one group. And then we managed to, you know, have spaces. So we had guest lectures from great glaciologists and ice core experts. And, we had the guy, Bruce Molnia, whose work you see in Inconvenient Truth, where he shows glaciers before and after, a historic photograph of an Alaskan glacier, and then one he took from the same vantage point, you know, 40, 50 years later. So he was on a cruise because he's an expert on Alaskan glaciers, USGS, I'm retired now. So I had a really good cruise, you know, and it was a really good experience because it had the conventional stuff all cruises have, you know, like ports of call and that kind of stuff. But it also had, you know, unique content that we offered in forms of talking about the science of climate change and glaciers. So that sort of made us realize we don't have to base everything out of Los Angeles. And then this was something about 2 years ago. It came around because my wife is a huge fan of this series on Starz TV called Outlander, which is based on Scotland, the 1700s, just before the Bonnie Prince Charlie and the Battle of Culloden. And so she got to be fanatic about this series, and she said, we got to find a way to go to Scotland. So that's when I started thinking about this. That's what led to it. So
what is your UFO book about?
Oh, it's a general debunking of almost all the basic UFO claims, which I discovered when I was doing all the research for it. Nobody's done it completely across the board. I mean, there are specific books on Roswell and Area 51 and, you know, a number of the UFO sightings and other books about, you know, UFO, you know, possession and all the rest. But there have been never anything that covers every single major topic, including alien religions and all this other stuff. And then on top of it, I wanted to frame it the same way I framed my book about cryptozoology, which is the only one of its kind, which is at the beginning talks about the scientific method and the quality of evidence required and the standards we expect to be able to prove things are true or not true. And then, of course, especially in the context of UFOs, why eyewitness evidence is worthless and how it's easily corrupted and easily modified and forgotten and all the other things. Of course, the things like conspiracy thinking and so on, which are so critical to UFO issues. All that kind of psychology of how people believe stuff that isn't real. And so that's all in there. And then at the very end, I wrote another chapter sort of bookend that where I talk about how, you know, people who are UFO believers think and what kinds of organizations they belong to and what they need to do if they want to ever be taken seriously as scientists rather than just crazies. So it's much more, you know, like the cryptozoology book we did 3 years ago. It's much broader than any book that's out there. We'll see how it's received, of course.
Do you go into the history of the sort of culture history of UFOlogy at all? You know, why do people see what they see and say what they say?
That's right. We brought that in a number of ways. I mean, one whole chapter is how the media have basically created the UFO industry, because it's what you see in the cultural memes, especially from certain media, especially from certain films. And this has also been true of cryptozoology too. Certain films like King Kong hatched the Loch Ness Monster version that we have now. And likewise, the certain, you know, images that we've seen in certain movies created almost all the memes. And the best way to sort of debunk a person who believes in flying saucers and aliens is say, why have there been no reports of these things prior to about 1890? because and then when they saw something in the sky they didn't recognize before then, they had a different cultural meme. They saw angels or devils or something like that, but they did not see UFOs. UFOs are a product of the mostly 20th century and science fiction, and how they've changed our ways of looking at things. Plus, I guess lots of people would argue that the lack of religious icon or, you know, iconology, that people don't think that they're looking for angels anymore, and they more often want to think it's a UFO when they see something in the sky they don't understand.
At a slightly more intense level, there's a phenomenon called culture-bound psychiatric disorders, which
relates to this,
in a sense, where, you know, today people might think that Bill Gates planted a chip in their head, you know, to control them. But in the Paleolithic, there was not that kind of chip. And so they must have been thinking something completely different. And so very similar patterns.
Like that, yeah.
Yeah. So very similar patterns are found across a wide range of instances that are really specific to the technology, like you say, the technology or what the current culture is giving us as far as media, movies, stories, religion, whatever.
Huh? Oh, yeah, it's very true. And then it's also this is particularly a case of what's called mass delusion. And so there's several cases that we put in the book, but the one I opened the entire book with in the preface is the famous airship hoax in 1903 or 1905, where a con man, just shortly after Wright Brothers successfully flown, but of course then not much else was flying yet, a con man claimed that he had an aircraft that could fly in the sky for hours, and that it was flying at night over the heads of people in New England, and thousands of people claimed that they had heard it or seen it, and it of course never existed. And if that doesn't tell you what a UFO story is about right there, that's it in a nutshell.
That's a very good example.
Anyway, that's what I'm working on. And I've got to write a book for historical geology, which I've got to put more time into after I get back in August. And that'll be another task I've got to do. And then I've got another contract behind that, but we'll see how quickly I can get to it. These other things are going to come back to me. And then by late September, I'm back to teaching again. So I will work my tail off this summer so I don't get too far behind.
What has been the reaction to your cryptozoology book from the cryptozoologists? The people who think they know about Bigfoot and so on.
Mostly a profound silence, just like my creationism book was never read by creationists. They decided it's a skeptical book that isn't going to, you know, give them what they want to hear, then they just don't even bother to pick it up. And when you look at the Amazon reviews, you get mostly very, very positive reviews by people who either were sitting on the fence and not sure, or they were, of course, not very favorable to cryptozoology from the beginning, so they thought this book really did a great job of completely demolishing the entire field. But then there's one or two reviews in there, which are still there. It's rather amusing. One or two reviews in there from people who are the diehards who gave it a one-star review. It's the lowest they can do. And, of course, you read the review, it's clear they didn't read any more than a few pages of the book. They actually say so. And they basically say, well, this person, they didn't talk about this particular case. Or they have a trivial detail about this case of Bigfoot being wrong, which in most cases I think they're probably wrong, because my co-author who did the Bigfoot chapter, Dan Loxton, was very thorough and had every single case nailed down before he wrote his chapter, which is like 100 pages by itself. It usually tells me they just basically didn't want to confront any of it, and what they would do is pick on some little thing that told them that the thing wasn't telling them what they want to know, and they can find some way they can criticize it by some trivial detail and then ignore the rest of it. So that's what they call a book review. But there were people like, you know, the people of Cryptomundo and so on, Lauren Coleman and so on, who actually were fairly fair to it, even though I'm sure they were unhappy with its conclusions. But you know, it's not a community you can reach very easily. That's because it's all true believers, basically, once you get past a certain point. And it'll say, I'm sure the same will happen with the UFO committee. It's not going to reach them. It's going to reach people who want to understand it from outside. So
I think it's kind of interesting that cryptozoology and the UFO phenomenon or aliens phenomenon kind of have opposite histories in a way, because there's never actually been aliens, but there have always been species of undiscovered animals.
Right, right.
That don't happen to include. If you go back far enough in time, though, my ex-father-in-law, who passed away a couple years ago, Neil Tappan, is famous for having told, well, Edmund Hillary had come back from his conquest of Everest and went to find a bioanthropologist, a physical anthropologist. He ended up talking to Sherwood Washburn, who was Neil's advisor at the time. And they had lunch together. Hillary proposed the idea of Neil going out and helping to document and run down all the details about Yeti, because Hillary did not know that Yeti wasn't real. He didn't know either. He didn't know either way. He didn't know either way. Why would he? I mean, it really was actually.
Well, he wasn't there to look for that. There are other mountain climbers who did, however, though. So.
Yeah. So anyway, it was Neil that said, "I'll be the first to join your second expedition." But there was, you know, I think we've always been able to rule out an ape-like creature in cold climates in the woods. But there's always been some. It's been a while since we've discovered anything large.
That's right. But that's right. That's what they always say. Oh, well, what about those things were discovered, you know, like the gorilla and the okapi? Well, there hasn't been a century. None of those have been found in a century. And the world's wild places are nearly all well explored now. In fact, you can watch them from space now. So, you know, for especially things like Mokele Mbembe, supposedly living in the swamps of the Congo. Well, you can watch the swamps of the Congo from the air now. Something as large as they claim, you can actually watch. Because you can watch elephants in space now. So, you know, it's pretty ridiculous they think that this place is that remote. You know, there isn't that such thing. There's so many wildlife biologists traveling through all the Bigfoot country and all the, you know, the country of things like Mokele Mbembe that, you know, if there were something there, people who know what they're doing would have documented it, not that the amateurs usually blunder around that area. So
plus pretty much all of the species that have been discovered since including the okapi actually were not that much out of place. They weren't that unexpected.
That's right. They were a little different, a little more extreme than anything found before, but they're nothing in the context of, say, a surviving dinosaur, surviving plesiosaur, ape-like creature that doesn't belong on the Holocene. So that's why there's such a big gap between that claim and what they're claiming, you know. So, you know, and then as we went through the subject, you know, line by line, you know, they ignore so much of pertinent information. I mean, for lake monsters, for example, every one of the lakes is supposedly has a lake monster, whether it's Loch Ness or Lake Champlain or Lake, you know, down the line. Well, they were all under 2 miles of ice only 20,000 years ago. Right. And people sort of forget these are landlocked bodies of water. How do those things get there? And how, you know, especially when they're under ice, there was no place for them to live until that time, but the ice melted back. You know, this is all this kind of, you know, completely ignorant of the basics of science type of thinking that they do. So,
well, Lake Champlain in New York, which was under ice, has Champy, which is
that's right. Champy is the monster for it. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and he looks like the creature from the Black Lagoon. So he could have walked there.
Yeah, well, yeah, if you believe that version of it, yes. There's some that make it more like a Loch Ness monster. So
that's true. That's true. Yeah.
Again, of course, based on mostly cultural means. I mean, just like we point out that almost all the images of flying saucers and everything else in the UFO community can be directly traced to a particular movie or a particular set of cartoons or comic books where these ideas were introduced and then they spread. Most of in the standard iconography of cryptozoology comes from the same types of media influences. So, for example, you can trace the plesiosaur version of Loch Ness Monster to King Kong, 1933, and it had a sequence of stop motion plesiosaurs in it, if you ever go back to the original Willis O'Brien version of it. And then, and through that sequence, of course, you'll find, of course, that it's very convincing to people at that time. Within weeks, two different eyewitnesses saw something that reminded them. And of course, the film had been playing in Inverness. So they were very suggestible once they got this image in their head. And of course, you know, old legends, which don't specify what the creature looks like very much, are always around, but that's true of lots of places. But then it takes on its modern incarnation right after some media event that then creates a meme in everyone's mind to look for. And once that's publicized through the media, especially those days newspapers, and then the hoaxers add to it, you know, so the surgeon's photo was a famous hoax where the most iconic image of Nessie is actually a tiny little toy submarine with a little head stuck on it. Those all just end up becoming completely embedded in everyone's collective memory once they've been exposed to it. This is what they've heard, and that's what they will see no matter what they saw. They will see what they were primed to see.
Isn't there a sea monster buried under a soccer field or a cricket field somewhere in Great Britain?
No, I hadn't heard that one.
Yeah, it was. I remember a television documentary a while back. It was someone took a couple of a sea monster floated up on shore, and a local physician kept some of the vertebrae, so those are available. And the rest of it was buried, and now I think there's some kind of a sports field from a local high school is over the top now of the grave. But it was a basking shark, but one that had probably deteriorated in such a way it would deteriorate in such a way that it would look like a sea monster, a rotted dead sea monster.
A number of those things are decomposed basking sharks. Look very bizarre when they break apart like that. So, Well, in most cases, however, that not just with Nessie, but also with Champy, and then of course with things like Roswell, New Mexico, and Area 51, they want to, if anything is possible, not cover it by soccer field, but have. So one of the common problems you discover is that things like paranormal things like cryptozoologists, zoological phenomena, and UFO phenomena are really profitable businesses. Roswell's economy is almost entirely sustained by the UFO crazies coming to town, especially the 4th of July weekend when they have their annual Roswell Festival with speakers and 5K race and everything else, you know, connected with the UFO industry. And that brings in more bucks than anything else they do in Roswell. And likewise, when we get to Loch Ness, of course, it's going to be another issue that we'll see. We're going to be at Loch Ness and Inverness, of course, and you'll go up and down the loch, as I've heard, and I will see it myself this summer. And everything there caters to Loch Ness tourism. It's a huge draw. So, you know, if instead of burying their creatures under soccer fields, most places, well, if anything is possible, they will try to promote them as far as they can because that brings in tourist bucks.
But basking sharks, too, have been used by creationists in their versions of cryptozoology, too, as dinosaurs that still exist, haven't they?
Mostly basking sharks, when they deteriorate, are interpreted as some kind of monster from the sea. I've never seen them interpreted as dinosaurs, though. So
I was thinking that Dr. Dino had done, Kent Hovind had done something like that where he claimed a picture of a basking shark. Was that?
Well, if he's talking about a sea reptile, which are not dinosaurs, yes. He might have been claiming it was a plesiosaur, which happened when the head falls apart. You get these long, stringy things that look like a neck. So that might have been what he was doing. And that's the same mistake a lot of these people make. The basking sharks and the rotting whales and things like that, when they fall apart far enough, they're easily misidentified for something else. People don't know any anatomy.
Well, when there is a void, people will fill it as well.
That's right.
Loch Ness is lucky to have a legendary monster. And Roswell is lucky to have aliens that crashed there, because there probably wouldn't be much else there. In St. Paul, there's an interesting thing. There's a cave you can go into. And I've not been to it, but there's a nightclub sort of thing, and you can take tours, and they talk about the gangsters that used to hang out there and do their rum running, and there's also ghosts. Nothing that they talk about on their tours ever happened. And the cave was basically just a mine that failed. Yeah. There was nothing in it, and then it was just a closed off mine. And then later they built this little nightclub thing and made it look like a 1920s thing. It's completely 100% fabricated, including and especially the ghosts. But even the gangsters are fabricated. Which is funny, because St. Paul has great gangster stories with real gangsters.
That's right. That's right.
But this cave is just completely made up. The whole story is made up. And I think they probably tell you that in the fine print when you go in and pay your $40 for the tour. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of those tourist traps all over the country which have fake histories and fake architecture and that kind of stuff that people walk into and don't realize it's all one big sham.
You don't get to blog much anymore because you're kind of busy. But one of the last blog entries that you had had was you did you did a book review of Dr. Lisa Randall's Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs. And I've been reading it off and on, picking it up here and there. And there was one part of it that you really kind of keyed on as a big mistake that she was making in the book, and that's, you know, what was actually the demarker for the KT boundary. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, she actually made several mistakes, which show that she's maybe a good astronomer, but she's not a good paleontologist, and I don't expect her to be one. And the major thing she made is she bought into the periodic extinction model, which has been dead as a doornail since about 1990. Back in the 80s, there was a big rush right after the initial rush of excitement about the KT extinction model that they would find evidence of periodicity. This was Dave Ralph and Jack Sikorsky at Chicago, who did this in 1982 and 84, 86. And they claimed they saw a regular repeated pattern of extinctions every 26 million years based on the data they collected at the time. And this led to a huge industry of people both trying to support it and debunk it. And by the end of the 80s, it had pretty well been debunked, because it turns out most of those peaks aren't real and the statistical separation on them isn't very regular. They're not exactly 26 million years apart, which almost any physical phenomenon would be much more precise than that. Pretty much Steve Stanley explained what was going on there, which is that mass extinctions can't happen too much closer than 26 million years apart, because it takes that long for the world to recover and to get extinction-prone species back, and they don't come back, you know, in the first 10 million years or so after a mass extinction, like the Permian extinction or the Cretaceous extinction. You have all these survivors and mostly weedy species, opportunistic species that are really widespread but not very diverse. And that is typical of any of these mass extinctions, that's what happens. And these things are also extinction-resistant at that stage, which means you don't find any evidence of if another big event happened, you wouldn't know it. And so that's why they space out about 20, 25 or more million years apart, because they can't really happen any sooner on a pace like that. And that's pretty much idea died. By 1990, that paper had just pretty well put that whole idea to rest. So it was very strange in her book to see an idea that was already 25 years out of date showing up in a book like this from 2016, or was it 2015, I guess, when it was published. So I was rather surprised. So that was the main criticism I had of her book, was that she dabbled in some aspects of paleontology that she didn't really know enough about to know how to find the right resources and find what was really held by the majority of paleontologists. Of course, there are cranks out there, Mike Rampino and people like that, who will continually push the envelope and make outrageous claims, but most of us don't take that tough stuff too seriously anymore because he's done this all his career. But she bought into that, and so that, and it ends up being a spinning point of her book. And then, you know, like many people, she just gets the simplistic notion of what happened at the end of the Cretaceous, with the extinction of not just the dinosaurs, but a wide spectrum of things from the base of the food chain with many of the plankton, such as the coccolithophorids and the foraminifera, right up through the ammonites and many other kinds of marine animals, and of course some land animals as well and land plants. And that simplistic story, which of course emerged right after the asteroid extinction model in the 1980s, is still the one that's held by most of the culture and most reporters. But in the geologic community, it's not the story that we follow, especially not in the paleontological community, because it turns out it's a complicated story. The end of the Cretaceous was marked by the second biggest volcanic eruptions in all of Earth history, the Deccan lavas of India and Pakistan, which must have had huge impact on the atmosphere and the rest, and must have been a major contributor. And there was also one of the biggest sea level drops of the entire Mesozoic right at the end, a giant regression all across all the most of the world. So the great interior seaway, in which all these marine animals lived in Kansas and Texas and South Dakota, just vanished, and so did their habitats. And so a lot of things are happening at once. So it's really ridiculous to claim that one event and one event only is responsible for it, when it's clear that too many things are happening at once to really tease out which cause is the most important. And it's pretty also clear, if you look at the fossil record of most things, that many or most of them are declining well before the rock from space shows up, which means they're probably being affected by climatic changes driven by the Deccan volcanoes and or maybe by the effects of changing sea level. And so the rock from space is more like a coup de grace. It's not the ultimate cause. It may not even be the most important cause of the extinction of most of these animals. And that's basically consensus among most geologists who know the facts of the story really well. And almost 100% of vertebrate paleontologists accept that. We know almost none of us are asteroid extinction model fans here among paleontologists, because I point out in my papers I've written about it, and also in some chapters I've written about it, what you're dealing with in paleontology is people who are more trained in biology and how systems are complex and nuanced, and there's usually no simple right answer. There's usually complex systems that respond in complex ways, versus a culture from, you know, especially from geophysics and so on, where they used to put them in an answer in a machine and get a simple right and wrong result, and then that's it. That's end of story. And so we tend to have a culture clash there. It's a sociology of science thing going on just as much as it is a clash over what the data show. And so that's been true ever since now, 36 years since the original Alvarez et al. Paper came out in 1980. And the only thing that's changed is that the tide shift back and forth a bit. So initially, you know, the asteroidization model was the dominant one of the 80s and the 90s. And then sort of went a slid out of favor for a while. The last two GSAs I've been to in Vancouver and last year in Baltimore, there were many more presentations on the podium about the Deccan lavas and their effects on climate than there were about asteroids.
Prior to Alvarez in 1980, the idea of the fossil record being comprised of many extinction events was not widely accepted. And right, having a way in which an extinction event could happen, even if it turned out that it wasn't really necessarily the way, let that come in, that idea come in and be considered right. More carefully.
No, I agree. Yeah. I mean, if you look at pre-1980 theory about extinctions, there was almost no discussion about mass extinctions as much of an idea. I mean, Norman Newell at the American Museum was one of the few who ever pointed to the fact that there were more than one mass extinction, that they seemed to have some interesting patterns, and he was almost talking to himself. And then it was the asteroid extinction paper in 1980 that really sort of launched the bandwagon, which in many ways went too far and got too far off of the track. but it still was important because it opened doors and it made people think differently. And, but, you know, it was at some points it got too extreme. So there was all this stuff, you know, the, within 2 years after the Alvarez paper, the same co-authors were claiming the Xenologus extinction was caused by an asteroid impact. And all they had was one place in Caribbean where they had one sample of iridium. And it turned out when people started looking at it closer that indeed there was an impact, but the impact that happened at the end of the Eocene don't happen at the end. They happened in the middle of the late Eocene, 35 and a half to 36 million years ago. And there's two impact sites we know of at least. One is, of course, Chesapeake Bay, which is an impact crater that's now covered up. The other is a spot called Popagai up in Siberia. And it may or may not have been the same impact with two different objects, but who knows? Dates are overlapping. But what it did was almost nothing. It's big. The two craters together are almost as big as Chicxulub in Yucatan, which is a KT crater, and they have virtually no effect. In the middle of the late Eocene, there are almost no extinctions of any group of animals or plants anywhere on the planet. And so they're the big counterexample to this idea that extinctions cause, or impacts cause extinctions. The second biggest extinction after Chicxulub causes nothing. The second biggest impact after Chicxulub causes nothing. And the same is true of a bunch of other impact craters you look at in the Cenozoic, which are well dated. There's nothing happening. The point being that this the impact bandwagon was really going crazy. I mean, I vividly remember at International Geologic Congress 1989 in Washington, D.C., Digby McLaren's getting up in front of the whole thing saying all extinctions are caused by impacts. And even David Raup was talking that way, although he is a provocateur. But that kind of thing was, you know, just getting carried away, you know, one or two cases. And then the irony is in retrospect, now that this has been researched over 35 years, the only mass extinction that's correlated with impact is the KT or KPG, if you want the modern terminology. There is nothing associated with the Permian extinction, which is far bigger, has no impact whatsoever that's ever been substantiated. There's no impact or any kind of thing associated with Jurassic extinction, the third biggest. Nor with the Devonian extinction, nor with the Ordovician.
I remember being at the AAAS meeting around that time when the Alvarez paper had already come out, and I think this was the first AAAS conference after that. Elders and Gould were talking about their thing, and people were talking about extinction. But the other two things that were being talked about heavily at that conference and debated were neutral theory, which basically says most of the genetic change that we are undergone on this planet is not related to adaptation or adaptive evolution.
The other, which,
by the way, is not incompatible at all with adaptive evolution because it doesn't matter that most of it is.
We now know most of our DNA is junk DNA, so it's really not even that controversial anymore. So
yeah, and the other thing that coming out was Sibley and Ahlquist's work. It had been out in literature for a while, but they had a major new study that was bigger, much bigger than what they had done before, which basically put this giant structure onto the evolution and the diversification of birds.
So
you've got this in the same set of rooms over the same few days, you have, you know, birds undergoing major radiations and you've got mass extinctions happening and you've got random genetic variation rolling along in the background. And it kind of was this one week that put evolution all together. And for me, it was interesting because I was not yet an evolutionary biologist. I was an archaeologist, and I was just beginning to take classes in this stuff. And I thought, wow, this field's really dynamic. It's constantly changing. Everything's different, which is true, but hardly ever has it been as true as it was that year for that couple of years.
Yeah, there are always fields that are cutting edge that are making everyone to head turn. But that year and those years around that time, well, that was also when I was finishing my doctorate too. And I finished in 1982. So I went to a lot of mostly Geological Society of America meetings and others as well where everything was happening like that. And those meetings, you know, it was just, you know, it was really invigorating to go to these sessions and watch these knock down, drag out shouting matches, you know. And of course I had come from the American Museum of Natural History in the '70s. And every meeting I ever saw at the American Museum of Natural History in the '70s was not sedate. It was violent. You know, that people shouted at each other because this was during the heyday of when colitistics was still sweeping halfway through the American Museum at that point, and I was in the middle of it. And then right about the late '70s when the vicarious biogeography came to the American Museum, and that was equally, violent. So I remember one session where this guy got up and gave a hour long presentation on a histology of bat penises. Was about the most soporific talk I'd ever seen in my life. But the minute his talk was over, he concluded with the idea that the microbats and megabats, the megacoroptera and microcoroptera, were not closely related to each other. that are all these things that they have in common. This must be parallel evolution. And that just set that room on fire. And then there was shouting matches and screaming and people saying, this is character assassination. And it was just a typical day at the American Museum then. I don't think it's quite as violent. The major players are no longer there. So
he turned out to be right, correct?
No. He was wrong. He was basing it on just a handful of characters from penis histology, but there's too many other characters that overwhelm it to take it seriously.
There are two separate monophyletic groups, right?
Yeah, well, they're both monophyletic groups, but yes, they're also sister taxa.
Oh, yeah, okay.
He was trying to establish that one of them was closer to the Dermopterans, Calugos, either was to each other. And that was not very well established by his data. It wasn't, you know, all that stuff he showed us, he only had a handful of characters he was able to pull out.
Yeah, well, the DNA came along to help solve that problem.
Right, yeah. Well, and then I was also in the late, as I saw through the 90s, especially all the work I did on cladograms of mammals was instantly sort of challenged by the DNA stuff and molecular stuff coming along. First it was proteins and immunological distances, and then eventually DNA sequencing by the end of that decade. And so some of what I published turned out to be supported and some didn't. And of course, you know, as a scientist, that's what you can best hope for. You know, you don't expect to be 100% right all the time. So, but it was interesting to watch. I had to, you know, I was fighting a rear guard for some time there for trying to defend my ideas. And some of that I've been able to hold on to. Some I've had to reject. So this prehistoric mammals, a book I'm writing right now, I'm finally throwing in the towel after resisting it when I did the paleontology textbook 3 years ago and going ahead with phylogeny of mammals. It has all the molecular groups on it now. So even though all my colleagues who work on these animals have still not found anything other than molecular characters to support things like Afrotheria and a bunch of these other clades, you know, there is nothing anatomical or otherwise. It's all molecular, which makes me a little bit nervous.
Well, as DNA started to become more widely used tool, people did expect it to solve problems a bit better than it ended up doing. I remember talking to an incoming graduate student at Harvard about what she was going to do, and she said that she didn't want to deal with fossils. There were basically three things she could do: endocrinology, fossils, and DNA, based upon who was there at the time, or primates, I guess. And she said, "I'm going to do DNA and not fossils because fossils are impossible to understand, and DNA is truth." And so I said, okay, fine. So I remember asking her about that a couple of years later when she was still working on her DNA thesis, and she was on her fourth or fifth topic because nothing was working out. And she basically got her PhD done in about the same amount of time that the fossil people got their PhDs done. In other words, she kept coming up with, and she wasn't doing phylogeny. She was doing balanced polymorphisms, but she kept hitting problem after problem after problem after problem. And eventually she gave up on that and went to phylogeny and did some really good DNA phylogeny. but most of which confirmed the fossil and that anatomical tree that had already been developed. So it's interesting. It isn't quite as easy. It isn't quite as straightforward. And I think there's truth in the fossil record about the actual structure that puts together both adaptation and time and space, that the DNA, because of neutral evolution, the DNA will never see those details.
That's right. Well, and they're only dealing with living taxa, too. So, I mean, as a paleontologist, it's frustrating because so many of our things we want to understand have nothing that's biologically available to us to even talk about this thing. And so there are lots of groups that just simply don't have any place in this thing. I would love to have Panodont DNA and Taenodont DNA and so on. But then you saw the study published last year, where they, of course, the DNA is no longer around, but they managed to get protein sequences out of Macrachenia and out of Toxodon from South America. So now we finally got an answer to where at least two of the major South American groups, the notoungulates and the lytoterns, apparently are both sister taxa to Perissodactyls based on proteins, which is something we could never have done with the bones. No one's ever found anything really strong to support them in one way or another. So
the real cryptozoology.
That's right.
What is your take on the current state of the overall skeptics movement? Because you're one of the key players in that movement. And I guess I'm going to have to look this up and edit this question later. There was a guy on TV who did, he's a comedian, who did a basic routine about science, about how people who don't accept science are wrong, and how it was basically a screed that you would expect to hear from someone like you or any other skeptic.
Would it be Ricky Gervais?
No, it wasn't him. It was
one of the really famous. Sort of like that, but maybe there could be other ones too.
this is the Tonight Show guy or one of those guys. And it got replayed on the internet again and again and again and again and again. And it suddenly made, he was talking mainly about global warming, but it suddenly made me realize that the skeptics movement sometimes is really being ignored by the rest of the world. It's only when it breaks through in these places where everyone else is already watching that it actually gets.
Jimmy Kimmel did something like that about 2 weeks ago.
That's what it was.
Yeah, Jimmy Kimmel. You just look it up. Jimmy Kimmel tonight, and he did an episode where he basically talked about how stupid it was that people couldn't accept what scientists have been telling us all this time, and then he got a whole bunch of scientists to swear on network television that we're not fooling you and we're not trying to fuck around, that kind of thing. What he said. So yeah, that's Jimmy Kimmel. I played at my classes last quarter. So yeah, that's what you're thinking of. So yeah, it's funny because skepticism is still a very small number of people who are really dedicated and really do a lot of stuff toward it and regularly attend meetings. You know, and some of these meetings have a broader base, like the Amazing Meeting had a broader base of skeptics and atheists and other types of secularists, and they could draw, you know, a lot of science content into it. So the Amazing Meetings had, you know, some barely big turnouts of, you know, 1,500, 2,000, that kind of thing. But now it's kaput, you know, as soon as the guy who runs the Randy Foundation and put some money behind it decided he didn't like the way it was going anymore, he pulled the plug on it and it's done. So there is no Amazing Meeting this year in Vegas as there would be in mid-July. Although they're going to try to revive it. CSI is going to revive something similar, you know, in October, which I can't go to because at the same time as Society for Urban Intelligence meeting, which I would never miss. And then likewise, you know, here the Skeptic Society is changing its characteristics too. I mean, for years we had a monthly, sometimes twice a month talk at Pasadena, at Caltech, and this big audiences of 400 plus people, and it was a big draw, and a lot of, you know, people trying to sell their book products and so on would come by and speak because it was a good audience to speak to, and we tended to buy a lot of books. And then we ran into a problem. Caltech changed their rules, and we're not allowed, non-Caltech organizations are allowed to use campus auditoriums anymore, and we couldn't find any other venue to do it in. And Shermer looked around and around for months trying to find some other venue that would work, and nothing else worked that wasn't too expensive. So they ended up, he changed the whole format. So what he has now is a more of a salon type thing with 40 or 50 people who pay quite a bit more money, but they get a free copy of the author's book. And then they meet, you know, like in this really fancy glass house that has an amazing view from the top of the mountain. But it's a tiny salon. It's only 40 or 50 people. There's no projection or audiovisual. And it's done in a very more like an interview format rather than a talk. And so the speakers don't mind because the speakers who come automatically sell every book that they brought. But it really cuts back on the number of people who participate. And partly, you know, because Shermer didn't have a choice, he couldn't find another place to replicate what he used to do at Caltech. And partly because his own life is changing. He now has a young baby. And so he really doesn't have the energy and time to devote to that kind of big meeting twice a month. And so everything changes, you know. And so the Skeptic Society is changing direction. I'm not sure exactly what it'll look like in 5 years, because really it's Shermer and Pat Lindsay and just a handful of the rest of us who help them out. That's what it is. So it's funny. The skeptics movement has done different things. I mean, when this Amazing Meeting started over 10 years ago, it was the only show in town and it could draw all the major speakers and all the big names. And then there has been a giant sort of a let a thousand flowers bloom phenomenon where now there are skeptical and secular conferences and atheist conferences in almost all the major parts of the country several times a year typically. And there's three or four big ones, you know, like the Northeast Conference of Science and Skepticism and the ones you guys have in Missouri and Minnesota that happen at least once a year. And so it's really sort of become grassroots now. It's spread to almost every place that has sufficient population to do it. And the big meetings like TAM no longer have, you know, the kind of ability to draw the same speakers because there's too many of these things competing with it now. And so they really sort of starved out of their position where they're really not that exceptional anymore. That's part of the reason they closed it down. So in some ways it's good. Skepticism is now widespread in most parts of the United States, and there are large organizations in almost every major population area. But in some ways it's not so good because there aren't these, you know, giant meetings anymore where you can meet a lot of people all at once and see people you otherwise wouldn't see. So,
well, it may be more extinction resistant now.
Well, I'm sure it's more extinction resistant because you know, the internet has made secularism and atheism much easier for people to reach who normally wouldn't have any knowledge of it if they lived in a small town was surrounded by church people. Now they have the internet that lets them find out what's really going on. And that's the kind of people, I mean, all those people who went to the amazing meeting all those years, mostly had never met each other in person. They only knew each other by virtue of the internet. And then, of course, the meeting brings them together in person, which, of course, makes them behave even stranger. You know, that meeting had its history of long and bizarre events that happened, you know. So, but anyway, the whole point of it being that you know, I think it's deeply entrenched now. I mean, look at the number of all the poll numbers showing the number of non-believers of any particular faith or just not, you know, not a church going people. We're the second largest group in the country behind the Roman Catholics. And we're heading upward, you know, we've already passed most of the evangelical Protestant groups. And, you know, in a couple of years, maybe a decade or so from now, it'll be much easier for someone who is not religious to be taken seriously and even run for office. Right now, there's only a couple in the whole country that have successfully, you know, held their posts and not been religious or not been Christian in this case, mostly.
You've got one
Muslim congressman from your area, but that's a pretty rare exception.
And or people who are openly or religious versus not openly religious.
Right, right.
I think a lot of politicians pretend to be a little religious when they are.
Yeah, they have to play the lip service to it. But boy, well, to me, to watch Donald Trump pretend to be religious when he really has spent almost no time ever reading the Bible. And yet all the evangelicals fall in line with him, despite the fact he's about as big a sinner as they've ever backed and not repent in the least. There was an interesting article in Los Angeles Times today saying really what's going on here is that Trump is his own religion, his own faith. He's got people who believe in his message. And it really doesn't matter that he isn't conventionally religious because these people have bought into his faith rather than into the faith that they usually follow. And so all these various, you know, pundits who said Trump could never win over the Republican nomination because he wasn't religious enough, just all got blindsided by that, as we all did, basically. So follow Catholicism very closely.
There was also the idea, too, that because the Old Testament God was such a jerk, Donald Trump is just as capricious and reminds him of them, the Old Testament guys.
Well, I wouldn't put that past them too much, but yeah, that's a possibility. So, yeah, and the other side of that coin is funny how much Bernie, you know, never said much about his Jewish roots, but, you know, he came as close to being agnostic as any real major presidential candidate we've ever had. But of course, it didn't enter in the conversation. Nobody really hardly ever mentioned it because it's not an issue from the people that back him. You know, some are religious, some are not, but that wasn't what drew them to Bernie at all. So and that day is coming when it will be not just subtle, but open that the candidate is openly not religious and it won't matter.
Well, Don, I think we've covered everything. We've basically filled up our time. Okay. Well, Don, thanks very much again.
Thanks for calling. I appreciate it. It was a great, great interview. Appreciate it.
Yeah, we'll talk again sometime, I hope.
All right.
Thank you for listening to Iconocast. This is Mike Hobrick and Greg Layden. This is episode number 7. Our guest was Don Prothrow. Please be sure to go to iconocast.com, where you can purchase books that Don's written through Amazon, and your purchases there will help support future episodes of Iconocast. Thank you very much, and we look forward to having you listen to episode number 8, and we'll be announcing that shortly.